Did a love story go terribly awry? Or did a man's reputation in town cloud a tragic but innocent death? Episode 63 of Crime Over Wine starts right now. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Crime Over Wine, the only podcast with head-scratching true crime stories that are just better over a bottle of wine. I'm your host, Liam Collins, and this week, you are going to hear directly from a man who lived through our story this week firsthand. I have an interview with McCracken Poston Jr., a defense attorney in North Georgia whose book, Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom, is out right now. But before we get there, of course, we have wine to drink. This week, we are drinking Portlandia's Cabernet Sauvignon. It begins with aromas of blackberry, vanilla, and coffee, followed by layers of flavors of black cherry, dark plum, and sweet spices. It's structured by fine, firm tannins and well-integrated acidity and a balanced finish. And you all know how much I love my Cabernets. I have had this one many a time. And so, it's usually been more like recreational drinking. And so I am very excited to taste this with you all professionally. So cheers to you all. Okay, so those dark fruit flavors, there's dark red fruit flavors like black cherry, dark plum, those all very much so come out, but it's typically a little bit more of a softer kind of wine than you all know that I typically go for. You all know I love my big bold flavors, and these have some pretty big bold flavors, but it's definitely tamer for sure. And layered flavors, sweet spices in the back, 100% vanilla on around the edges. Blackberry is still pretty strong. But other than that, it is really just a very, I usually enjoy this one, when I'm winding down for the night, you know, really just kind of, you know, have my shows on the TV and just kind of trying to turn the brain off for the night. And this is usually the one that does the trick for that. And so I hope that you all are doing the same this week, listening to this week's podcast. I don't have a guest this week, like I said, just an interview, because we're trying to change things up a little bit. And hopefully you guys like this setup for the week. And so let me tell you all about the story that I'm going to tell you about, because it is a interesting one. It's going to be a little bit different than what you all are used to on Crime Over Wine, for sure, right? Again, we're taking a total left turn for episode 63, I guess. But this week, I want to tell you all a story about a couple whose lives became shrouded in mystery for years, as the way they chose to live raised a few eyebrows in the small town where everyone knew everyone. This week, I want to tell you the story of Virginia Ridley, the wife of the Zenith Man. Alvin and Virginia Ridley were just madly in love. They were living in Ringgold, Georgia, a small town just about 30 minutes south from Chattanooga. The couple met in 1964 when they became pen pals while Alvin was serving in the military. And just 2 years later, when Alvin was 23 and Virginia was 18, the two got married and moved in together into a small house just outside of the proper city limits of Ringgold. Alvin had owned and operated a small TV repair shop in downtown Ringgold. It was called Zenith Color Television, Ridley TV Sales and Service. It was the only TV repair shop in town, and he was incredibly proud of his technical skills. He was really, really good at what he did. So much so, he became known around town as the Zenith Man. He could practically look at any television set and know what was wrong with it and what needed to be done to fix it up without touching a thing, practically. But on top of having a really good reputation for being a good handyman, he also had a kind of cryptic reputation for being a bit off-putting to locals. People around town called Alvin Ridley Crazy Alvin for being a bit reclusive and hostile toward people who he would come across. People in town described him as having a strange look in his eyes. They said he would keep to himself and came across a bit sinister and very odd, making children and adults alike just very uneasy. According to an episode of Forensic Files about this case, people reported that Alvin would often hide behind bushes of his own house and peep and stare at passersby. It put him at odds with people in town. He was well known for filing lawsuits against people who he believed had wronged him. It certainly made him some enemies, even some from local law enforcement agencies. He eventually filed a lawsuit against the county, which he lost, and the judge ruled that Alvin should forfeit his van as payment, and he never let that go, saying it was seized from him without proper due process. But even when it seemed to Alvin like the world was out to get him, he always had his Virginia. Virginia Ridley was a tiny woman. She was described as resembling a doll, blonde hair and small facial features, and she was very shy. She would often not speak to anyone unless Alvin was there with her. And Virginia also suffered from a pretty severe medical condition. After a head injury she suffered when she was young, she was diagnosed with epilepsy, and it was something she struggled with for most of her life. But Alvin was always there to protect her and to take care of her, and they eventually fell on some pretty hard times. After some of the more frivolous lawsuits that Alvin had filed, the couple found themselves in public housing before being kicked out. As Alvin says, an exterminator had at some point entered their apartment unannounced to spray it down when he allegedly made a pass at Virginia, which made Virginia and Alvin both very, very, very uncomfortable. So Alvin made a pretty big fuss about it, and they were eventually evicted. After that, the couple had moved in an old, dilapidated house that Alvin had grown up in. It was cluttered and smelled, frankly. But according to Alvin, they were both very happy there. About a year into their marriage, however, Virginia's family started to get a little concerned about Virginia's well-being. They begin to hear directly from Virginia less and less and less. And they were starting to get worried, especially after hearing the rumors around town about how people felt about Alvin's odd behavior and the state of their home. On top of that, the rumors around town had started to float, and people started saying that Virginia hadn't been living at the house at all, but instead had possibly run off to Alabama or had moved into a mental facility. So in 1967, the family ended up instigating legal action to try and force Alvin to produce Virginia just to prove that she was okay. At one of their first hearings, Virginia actually showed up and explained to her whole family that she was okay and that she liked her married life with Alvin and that she just wanted to be left alone with him. Now, Virginia's family, you know, didn't necessarily like this, but they accepted it. She was a grown woman now and she could make her own decisions. So they left Virginia alone, only getting in contact with her on special occasions like birthdays or holidays. But as Virginia's sister would later tell Forensic Files, that was the last time that anyone would see Virginia alive. And they started to get worried that Alvin was intentionally trying to withhold her from her family and loved ones. Alvin actually admitted that he wasn't wanting any of Virginia's friends or family near her per her wishes. According to that episode of Forensic Files, he claimed that Virginia feared having a seizure in front of anyone except for Alvin. He was the only person that she truly trusted. And so for 30 years, no one remembered seeing Virginia at all. According to what Alvin's defense attorney, McCracken Poston Jr., later told the Washington Post, there were some reported sightings of Virginia at church and some at her house, but nothing really beyond that or really anything beyond what Alvin's own attorney said. She skipped weddings and even her own father's funeral in 1982. No one was allowed in the Ridleys' home to see Virginia. Family members would show up and reported that Alvin threatened to kill them if they returned. Virginia's parents even at one point got so desperate that they took out an ad in the local newspaper with the headline, "Parents Seek Married Daughter." Virginia's parents were convinced that Alvin was intentionally keeping Virginia from them, and they started to fear that something bad was happening to her. And those creepy feelings only started to get worse around 1982 when Alvin's father died. After that, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Alvin started acting strangely, even more strangely than he had been before when he created this, you know, again, creepy reputation for himself. People around Ringgold noted seeing him driving around town in a red sports car with a plastic dummy of a woman in the passenger seat, and the crazy Alvin nickname was only further cemented. And again, during this whole time, no one had remembered seeing Virginia at all. The town and Virginia's family were starting to get worried and suspicious of Alvin's behavior. And that was all reinforced on October 4th, 1997, when police get a call from Alvin himself. saying that Virginia was dead. Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to betterhelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp.
Hello, everyone. It's Heather Hawley, the co-host of Crime Over Wine Weekly, a brand new show keeping you up to date on the latest in the true crime world as it unfolds. We know how much you rely on Crime Over Wine on Wednesdays to learn about new cases, but on Crime Over Wine Weekly, you'll hear our takes on the cases making headlines right now. Join us every Sunday for a new episode of your new crime and wine obsession.
From a payphone just outside of the city limits of Ringgold, Alvin Ridley called police and told them that he woke up that morning and his wife, Virginia, wasn't breathing.
What's the problem?
I thank my wife, but is she breathing?
I don't think so.
You don't, does she have any medical problems or anything?
She's an epileptic.
Okay, but you don't think she's breathing?
I don't think so. Please hurry.
A few things seemed odd off the bat about this call. For starters, Alvin just seemed to be a bit too calm considering the shock that he had just woken up to. Plus, based on the story that he gave and the address he told to 911 operators, they could tell that Alvin had likely passed right by a fire department, which would have been his quickest method of getting any kind of help for Virginia. Nevertheless, when first responders arrived at the house, they are alarmed by its state. It was, you know, again, just totally disheveled, an absolute mess. It reeked of cat urine and was bug infested. There were cockroaches and ants everywhere, and the home didn't have any running water either. When they get to the back bedroom, they see Virginia in bed, still fully clothed and obviously deceased. But she looked just as in bad of shape as the home that she was living in. According to the episode of Forensic Files on this case, her hair was in knots. It didn't look like it had been combed in years. And she looked severely emaciated, as though she hadn't eaten a thing in months or maybe even possibly years. According to Alvin's story, Virginia had died in her sleep, possibly from a seizure. But the medical examiner wasn't so sure. Rigor mortis had already set in on Virginia's body, indicating that she had likely been dead for at least 8 hours by the time investigators had shown up to the home, but making it really difficult to determine an exact time or cause of death. After performing her autopsy, the medical examiner finds evidence of strangulation. She had deep bruising on the muscles in her neck and petechial hemorrhaging in her eyes, both likely indications of strangulation. So the medical examiner declares Virginia's death a homicide by strangulation with a secondary cause of epilepsy. In the report, the medical examiner also notes rumors that she had been held captive. And look, you all know about how I feel about narratives being included in official autopsy reports. It just feels so inappropriate to include non-scientific evidence, but especially rumors about being, you know, included in these kinds of official reports about someone's death. But I'll just digress there. You all know where I'm going with this. 7 months later, in May 1998, Alvin Ridley is arrested and charged with Virginia's murder, and it's big news in a small town like Ringgold, Georgia, especially considering the uncomfortable reputation that he had developed around town. Investigators argued that Alvin looked at Virginia as a liability, someone who was draining his finances and who he really wanted to get rid of. So he did. Investigators pointed to the inconsistent stories they gave about Virginia's death. Plus, they noted the odd circumstances surrounding her death. The fact that no one had seen her for 30 years, the doll in Alvin's front seat, plus the fact that Alvin passed the fire department, which, again, would have been a sure way to get Virginia medical attention as quickly as possible, and drove to a payphone out of town to call for help. Virginia's family was sure that Alvin had something to do with Virginia's death, either directly or indirectly. Either he killed her or he didn't do enough to save her. Investigators had noted that Virginia had severe epilepsy, and based on searches that they did of the home, they found out that Virginia had stopped taking her epilepsy medication in 1977, 20 years before she died. And after looking within a 50 to 100 mile radius of their home in Ringgold, they couldn't find a single doctor or pharmacist even who had seen or treated Virginia in the 30 years that she had been married to Alvin. And so the town swirled about the scandal that was rocking Ringgold, about crazy Alvin, the Zenith Man, the man who neighbors were sure was going to hurt somebody someday. It was just a matter of time. And so Alvin hired McCracken Poston, a young attorney with a big name in town.
I'd been in politics for a decade. I'd pretty much concentrated on that constituent service as opposed to client service. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I ran for Congress and got the hell beat out of me and was pretty much, you know, rolled out of politics just because of the changing Georgia. And so, you know, Alvin gave me a second act. He also ultimately allowed me to pick criminal defense as pretty much my concentration. And that's pretty much all I've done for the last 20 years.
McCracken told me that Alvin was one of the most difficult clients he had ever worked with. He wrote in his book, Zenith Man, Death, Love, and Redemption in a Georgia Courtroom, that Alvin didn't trust him one bit and refused to cooperate with McCracken, holding on to evidence for himself, instead of just turning it over to McCracken so he could work diligently to defend him.
And I will say that going in, finishing the trial in the courtroom where Virginia was last seen was so eerie that it just made me think, what if, you know, what if she was pulling the strings and making Alvin and I do this dance to where we end up infesting the first courtroom with scores of roaches because Alvin would not allow me to keep the evidence or treat it for that matter. He brought it every day. He took it home and reshuffled the order, the semblance of order that I tried to put it in, and left the suitcases open. It gets full of roaches. He brings them to the courthouse. He opens them up. The roaches get out. If you'll watch the Forensic Files episode, juror Kimberly Barnes is talking about the roaches coming out of the suitcases. And so Judge Van Pelt said, look, we're moving into the large courtroom. His office was right next to the small courtroom, which was getting full of roaches. So he wanted to fumigate that courtroom and put us in the large courtroom. Well, I was excited because that was the last place Virginia had ever been seen. And now we're using her own words to defend Alvin. And it just really lifted me. It got me kind of charged up about it because it was not always an easy case. Things were not always going our way. And so it was a wonderful, eerie feeling. Yeah, I mean, you know, you just think this guy's been weird all along. He used to post missives on the inside of the glass of his shuttered building that had been shuttered for 15 years, and was the weather was getting in it, and it was just a nasty place. And I would go read them to see if I'd made the list, you know, of people he was damning. But my dad always had kindness in his heart for Alvin. Now, my dad was going through, suffered from alcoholism. And it was not easy as a kid. Nothing mean, it wasn't a mean bone in his body, and he never was abusive toward any of us. He was just a sad alcoholic. And a kid can just torture their own minds to try to figure out, what is my role in this? Why is he like this? You know, maybe I'm not doing what I should be doing. And so I realized when I was writing Alvin's story, I started realizing what I was going through. I started reading my late mother's journals about kind of, you know, I wanted to see if she referenced the time I brought Alvin to her house a couple of times, you know, to mm-hmm. see my parents, just to calm him down. And again, my dad had a great calming effect on Alvin. But I remembered that we had an intervention. We put our dad in a hospital, and he had a reaction to some Ambien, and I went and stayed with him. And we ended up talking about my meeting Alvin on the street and talking to him. And my dad said, you know, son, he's just different, but he's a good man. And so I tried to start seeing him as my dad saw him, and not as Ringgold as a majority of Ringgold saw him.
Right.
He was the boogeyman. People were afraid of him, and he was acting that way. He would be reacting to the way people were treating him. Hmm. It was a vicious cycle.
McCracken said he was starting to lose hope that he would win his first big case since his humiliating loss while running for Congress. With Alvin refusing to cooperate with him and the beginning of his trial coming closer and closer, he started to think that Alvin may be convicted. And he started to believe that Alvin may have actually been responsible for choking his wife to death. But Alvin finally allowed McCracken to come to his house to look around the supposed crime scene. And the second that McCracken enters this home, he finds something that he believes could finally turn the tide in their favor. Get ready for that big test with Study.com. Study.com offers learning materials and test prep, even LSAT study prep guides for all of my legal nerds listening. Unfortunately, there aren't any wine study guides, and believe me, I did check. Listeners can get 30% off their first 3 months of any subscription level using the promo code CRIMEOVERWINE. Again, that's promo code CRIMEOVERWINE, no spaces, for 30% off your first 3 months at Study.com. Learn faster, stay motivated, study smarter with our sponsor, Study.com.
Hello, Crime Over Wine listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
Inside of Alvin and Virginia Ridley's home were walls covered in these really elaborate letters detailing practically every single moment in Virginia's very simple life. Virginia had written about what Alvin, not even herself, had for dinner, that they had watched Elvis Presley on television one night, and that they had spent one day cleaning the basement. Another note listed the cast of the Waltons. There were entire passages of the Bible transcribed. The notes also confirmed that Virginia did indeed stop taking her epilepsy medication some 20 years earlier, relying instead on her faith in God to heal her. But above all else, the notes confirmed what Alvin had been telling McCracken all along, that Virginia was madly in love with Alvin and he with her. The letters detailed their simple yet altruistically joyful life together, and McCracken said that was the moment that it was clear to him that Alvin wouldn't have ever done anything to hurt Virginia. McCracken says he immediately realized that Virginia may have had a much more severe and compulsive condition that may have contributed to her death, and he believed that he would turn the tide to prove Alvin innocent of his wife's murder.
The one expert, the epilepsy expert, Dr. Braxton Bryant Wanamaker from South Carolina, He was brilliant. He not only explained the markings on Virginia's body as being from a seizure, but he also explained the voluminous writing that I had found in the house. He explained it as an adjunct of temporal lobe epilepsy, a condition called hypergraphia. And that, to me, that was the one of the weird things. I thought, how can I explain why this lady's writing everything down? But now I could. And then that was a high point.
A handwriting expert would later confirm during the trial that the letters were indeed written by Virginia. And although that was enough for McCracken to know the truth about the way that Virginia died, he knew it would not be enough on itself to convince a jury or even a judge. But that was the beginning of the holes that McCracken was going to try to poke in the prosecutor's story about what they believe happened to Virginia. In court, McCracken lays out a totally different picture of the life that the Ridleys lived and the tragic way that Virginia died. Instead of Virginia dying just totally unkempt and not taken care of, McCracken said that Virginia had died with recently polished nails and her hair done up in pins, and not this emaciated mess that investigators and the medical examiner had noted her to be. Plus, those bruises on Virginia's neck, McCracken was preparing to argue, were not from strangulation, but instead, an expert testified in court that they were from the medical examiner herself. A pathologist testified for the defense that the bruises could be attributed directly to the needles that the coroner used to withdraw blood in the autopsy process. The pathologist had testified that the coroner's method of withdrawing blood from the neck was likely to have led to the bruising directly and was against proper autopsy procedure too. But on top of that, McCracken's expert testified that the same symptoms that had led investigators to point to a homicide by strangulation led him to believe that it was more likely a symptom of Virginia's epilepsy. The expert testified that the petechial hemorrhaging in Virginia's eyes were more likely to be the result of a seizure, which, you know, would be backed by the fact that Virginia hadn't been taking her epilepsy medication for years. All of this added up to McCracken, and he believed that despite Alvin's strange behavior, that he was an innocent man. McCracken wrote in his book that this was around the time that he started to kind of like Alvin, that all of the oddities and difficulties started to become kind of endearing, actually. And so when Alvin told McCracken something that any lawyer would hate to hear from a client, he didn't put up as much of a fight as he would have. And during the course of the trial, Alvin told McCracken that he wanted to take the stand. Crime Over Wine is proud to support EmancipPet. Veterinary care shouldn't be a mystery, and neither should your pet's health. EmancipPet's licensed veterinarians have answers to all of your pet questions. In the Vet Ed video series, veterinarians break down topics from spaying and neutering to protecting your pet in cold weather. Learn more at EmancipPet.org and watch Vet Ed on the EmancipPet YouTube channel.
It's Michelle Herron, the co-host of Crime Over Wine Weekly, a brand new show keeping you up to date on the latest in the true crime world. We know how much you rely on Crime Over Wine on Wednesdays to learn about a new case. But on Crime Over Wine Weekly, you'll hear our takes on the cases making the headlines. Join us every Sunday for a new episode of your new crime and wine obsession.
Alvin Ridley takes the stand in his own murder trial against his attorney's best advice because he says he has nothing to hide. For starters, he explains that he loved Virginia and would never have done anything to hurt her. They barely ever argued, let alone resorted to violence. Alvin said that his reputation in town was the product of his natural reluctance to trust people, even in his moment of his most desperate need. He told the same story that he had told to 911 operators when he called them about Virginia. He said he woke woke up, was getting going for the day, and was trying to wake Virginia up when he realized that she wasn't breathing. So without a working phone, he drove to the nearest payphone he could find, which was indeed past the fire department that he was criticized for not stopping at. But he said that he had a run-in with the people at the fire department before, and he just didn't trust them to help him. Alvin said that he had actually first called the hospital in Chattanooga to tell them what had happened. It was the only hospital he knew because it was the same hospital that he took his father to when he was sick. That's what he, you know, when he was told to call 911, which is what he did. And after hearing this story and the defense that McCracken put on for Alvin, it all seemed to make perfect sense to the jury, because after just 2 hours, the jury came back and found Alvin not guilty. Do you remember when the jury went to deliberate, did you feel confident enough that they were going to return a not guilty verdict?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because anything could happen.
Yeah.
I gave up on trying to guess jurors or predict their verdicts. I just knew that I had put up the best defense that I possibly could, but I didn't know if that was going to be enough. I worried very much about Alvin. I don't think he would live very long in any kind of custodial situation. And so I just felt a little guilt as well, because I just thought, man, I wasted a lot of time arguing with this guy. When I walked out on the porch of the courthouse, and I tell you, that porch has meant so much to me over the years, and to Alvin. We both sought office, and we both gave speeches on that porch. I did so more than Alvin because I was in office and for a few years. But we both had done that, and it was meaningful to us, and it was it stood for something. And yet here we are now out there facing the media and a crowd that has spilled out of the courthouse. And I got to tell you, it was the best experience I ever had on that courthouse steps, on that porch. And so I was just winging it. And I said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Alvin Ridley, a free man and an innocent man. And then I said, and a man who wants to restore his reputation in this community. And I went back and listened to it on one of the local TV stations' feeds. And I think maybe I've finally done that with this book. And it's kind of the definitive statement of, here's how we got Alvin wrong. And so I'm hoping that's what this book does.
The judge in Alvin's case said the coroner who originally performed Virginia's autopsy had allowed her personal biases, informed by Alvin's reputation, to influence her investigation into Virginia's death. Alvin later moved back into the shack where Virginia had died, and he still lives there today. Today, as McCracken told me and wrote in his book, he is good friends with Alvin. He offers support to Alvin in his older age, and the pair get together regularly, often at a coffee shop in Ringgold that is ironically in the same location where Alvin's TV repair shop used to be. McCracken told me that he wanted to be the one to tell Alvin's story, and he felt that he was the best person to be able to do that. Over the years, McCracken has done several podcasts, interviewed for a few books, and the pair even appeared in that episode of Forensic Files that I referenced so many times in this episode. And after the attention that Virginia's case got, a former jury member wrote in to McCracken to offer some insight that may have explained the odd behavior Alvin had been exhibiting that got him his bad reputation and ultimately got him his charges for murdering his wife.
You know, Alvin gave me a second act. Well, here's this odd guy. That's pretty much all these stories left it with, is what an odd guy. But, you know, we think he looks innocent in this, and but otherwise he's really strange. And the autism diagnosis, which was suggested by a former juror speaking to Will Davis, a podcaster at UTC, who was doing a long series podcast about the case. He was interviewing a former juror in Alaska. And she said, you know, I've become a nurse since I was on that jury, and I really think, you know, Mr. Poston should see if Alvin is autistic. Well, with his permission, I immediately made an arrangement with a doctor in Atlanta who dealt with adults with autism. And Alvin wanted me to go. And one of the two questions in the evaluation, the doctor asked, tell me what these two statements, how it makes you feel. And one was, she's gotten under your skin. Well, Alvin recoiled. He just thought, that sounds horrible, because he was taking it so literally. And the other one was, he wears his heart on his sleeve. Well, Alvin said, I know what that is. He has an artificial heart. So I knew at that moment that everything just came rushing into my head. All of our difficulties, all of our struggles. And I'm left with a huge feeling of guilt. Guilt because Alvin's autistic mannerisms were used against him at trial by the state. Alvin's autistic mannerisms were things that I fought him over. You know, why do you want to talk about this ancient civil litigation why do you want to talk about the county taking your van when we have a murder case? And he would answer, well, I didn't do that, but the county did take my van. So to him, it was extremely logical. And to me, it was extremely illogical. And we fought. Now, we figured out a way to put up a defense. But it was a struggle. And I don't know if I've, you know, nobody, he was tested back in 1998. Nobody was testing for autism then. There was not a lot of talk about autism in adults then. There was talk about autism in children, and they had just come up with the spectrum talk. And the idea that this is a number of developmental disorders that and a lot of times the focus was, let's find a blame for it. And in reality, autistic people have been with us since time began. And many of our greatest minds and greatest artists and producers of contributions to our culture have been from people on the autistic spectrum.
Alvin still visits Virginia's gravesite regularly. There is this sweet moment in that episode of Forensic Files where Alvin is at Virginia's grave and a single tear falls down his face, just still torn apart by her death all these years later. McCracken offered to buy Alvin a tombstone next to Virginia so that they could rest next to each other for eternity. And when McCracken asked him what he wanted on that tombstone, he wanted Alvin Ridley, TV repairman. McCracken decided to write Alvin's story in his own words, describing their progression from lawyer-client to frustrating duo to lifelong friends. Today, McCracken recognizes that even his ignorance about autism and developmental disorders affected his ability to serve Alvin with vigor. But he believes that Alvin's story could be a lesson to everyone.
And Liam, there are 5.5 million estimated undiagnosed adults with autism. And unless they have families that are helping the neurotypical world interpret them, they're going to be having encounters with police and courts. And I can't help but think that they are getting the short end of the stick on that. They're probably in conflict with their lawyers. Probably a lot of them publicly appointed lawyers who are going to be very frustrated and overworked anyway. But then they have to deal with this person who's just not responding as the way you think they should. So I hope that the book does highlight this issue and perhaps includes on state psychological evaluations some type of rule out autism test. And now that I've seen it in Alvin, I'm seeing it everywhere. I have a current client with autism, a young man, beloved in his school. And, you know, he had a seizure. His grandmother called for an ambulance. And a lot of times, first responders are actual law enforcement officers. And, you know, he's coming out of a seizure and, of course, ends up with obstruction charges because being misunderstood and not responding as law enforcement thinks you should respond, that's what results in obstruction charges, sometimes mm-hmm. felony obstruction charges. Mm-hmm. So I immediately got it with this kid and confirmed it with his grandmother. Oh, yes, he's autistic.
Next week, we are going to do something a little bit different for you. You are going to be able to hear my full conversation with McCracken Poston Jr. So you can hear about his time working with Alvin Ridley and the friendship that followed in his own words. So thank you all so much for listening. We are going to put all of our sources on our website so you can read everything for yourself and probably come up with a few theories too. And if you are just loving this podcast and are just looking for a way to tell everyone and anyone about it, the best way to help people discover this podcast is by leaving us a 5-star rating and a review wherever you are listening right now. So make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we will see you next Wine Wednesday for another episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnougan Network.